Welcome to Wise and Nice, a true crime podcast with your hosts
Danny Armstrong
and Kelly Lee.
Please remember that we mean no disrespect to anyone mentioned in this episode or across any of the Wise and Nice platforms. We have an interest in true crime and related topics, and whilst we may offer our own personal views on certain items, it is meant to be educational and as light-hearted as possible. The information we present is collated from research gathered from the internet, and we reference and credit our sources wherever possible.
If you've liked what you've heard and want to join in with us, follow us on our socials, Instagram, Wives and Knives the Pod, Twitter, at Knives Wives, and Facebook, Wives and Knives Pod. We also have a little website where we post photographs and other information about the cases that we research. And this is wivesandknives.wixsite.com/my site.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Wives and Knives.
Hello everybody.
Hope you're all keeping well. Kelly, how are you? How has your week been?
Yeah, it's been all right. Thank you, dear. Not too bad. I'll try and recount something that I've done and that isn't mega boring. Shucks, that won't happen. I watched a really good documentary that was actually recommended by UK True Crime, and it was called The Last Mountain.
Ooh.
And I really enjoyed it. It's not true crime related at all, but it's just basically about this guy whose mum was like the most famous British mountain climber, and she sadly died on a mountain, and then when they were really little kids, him and his sister, and then he follows in her footsteps and becomes again a famous mountain climber, but sadly, spoiler alert, dies on a mountain. It was just really I ugly cried all the way through it, but I was just what a cracking documentary. It was really, really sad, but also really nice as well.
Yeah,
it was good.
Almost a tribute to them.
Yeah, it was. It was good, but like I say, nothing related to true crime, but it was recommended by UK True Crime, so the podcast on Instagram.
Nice.
Yeah, but I enjoyed it. It was really good.
Good.
I've just got one more. I met up with it. I met my friend Debs the other day and met her new puppy. Oh my gosh.
Nice.
So what cute. Is it Bedlington Whippet?
Yeah, Bedlington Terrier kind of thing.
Yeah. It's possibly a cross with a collie as well.
Oh, wow.
She's so cute. I just went over for hot chocolate, which was awesome, because my friend's got a new chocolate machine, and said puppy was asleep on the sofa, and I just grabbed her and held her in my arms as if she were a baby for about an hour and a half, and it was very, very cute.
Yeah, that sounds lovely.
Yeah,
that's brilliant.
It's really nice. So yeah, that's about me. Yeah, update for me this week. Yourself?
Good. I've not really done anything of interest, just normal life things. But last weekend, I was really bloody miserable and sad.
You were?
I was just... Well, I can safely say that cloud has lifted.
Oh,
very little has changed. I just feel better about things. So,
excellent.
Progress. As we all know, sometimes you just have those...
Yeah.
...weeks, couple of weeks, where you feel like everything's awful and you just want to scowl under a rock somewhere, but no, all's better. I'm fine, so
good.
Crack on, there we go.
Fabulous.
Yeah, much better. Had a lovely day yesterday, went to an exhibition in Lancaster called I Am Witch, which has been commissioned or ran by the Silver Spoon Collective, and it was paying homage to all the people that were trialled and killed as witches in the UK and Ireland.
Very interesting.
It was very interesting. It was quite sort of experimental, artistic pieces and very thought-provoking. I had a really great time looking around that with one of my friends, and then we went to a pub for lunch. So, cracking day, and I'm meeting some more friends later today. So, all's good, all's positive, all's nice.
Lovely.
There we go. So for this minute, we decided that we would look into some people that narrowly escaped becoming victims of
notorious criminals.
Indeed.
And I have three very sort of short mini incidents to tell you about, and Kelly has one longer one. So with that in mind, the first lady that I'm going to tell you about is an award-winning writer, and her debut novel was influenced by her experience, her brush with a serial killer. So the book is called Toto Among the Murderers, and it was the winner of the Portico Prize this year. And hearing about this book, it has jumped on my to-read list desperately. It is out of stock on Waterstones, out of stock on Amazon.
Wow.
But Waterstones can order it direct from the publisher, but we're talking like weeks.
Oh.
I could find it on eBay, but at a greatly inflated price. So I'm going to do a bit more digging, but I need to read this. It looks so good. So the story itself is set in the 1970s Leeds, Sheffield area, and this is a time when attacks on women and crime in general was quite prevalent in the media. So you've just had the Moors murders in the 60s, which was of course hugely reported. The Yorkshire Ripper's reign of terror is ever present. Ted Bundy's Son of Sam, they're going on in the US, and Fred and Rose West were at large. And it is Fred and Rose that really impacted this book. So, the book, as I said, really hard to get hold of at the moment, but I will tell you a little bit about the book, which relates to what happened to her. Honestly, it sounds great. So, this is the blurb of the book. Reports of attacks on women punctuate the news, and Jude takes off again, suffocated by an affair she's been having with a married woman. Already I'm sold on this. It sounds amazing. But what she doesn't realise is that the violence is moving ever closer to her home. There is Janice across the road, who lives in fear of being beaten up again by her pimp. And Nell, whose perfect life is coming undone at the hands of her boyfriend. At the same time, infamous murderers Fred and Rose West are stalking the country on the lookout for girls. Girls exactly like Jude. Like, everything from the back of that book, I'm like, oh my god, I need to read that. So the author is Sally J. Morgan, and she herself grew up in Yorkshire and speaks of a time when she would regularly hitchhike as an art student in Sheffield during the early 70s. So hitchhiking was the norm back then.
Yeah.
It seems to be, like, for me, I grew up in the 90s, born late 80s. Hitchhiking was something you just didn't do. Like, I have accepted lifts off people that I shouldn't have, like I think we all have in younger years, but it was never a thing. Whereas my mum speaks of a time when hitchhiking was pretty normal.
Yeah, totally.
How was it, like, for you?
Yeah, same as you, really. Not prevalent. Not recommended.
Yeah, it was always like, I knew what it was, but I knew you don't do that.
Yeah, totally right.
Kind of thing. So she speaks of her hitchhiking, and she says, it was unpredictable and risky, but you could get anywhere you wanted without spending a penny. Which, I can see the allure, and if everyone else was doing it, you'd think, yeah, it's fine. So Sally now works for the University of New Zealand, and she decided to write her first book after realising that years and years and years before, she had narrowly escaped being abducted by the West. So at the time, she was hitchhiking, and she was on a roundabout just outside of Gloucester, and this was 1973, when a small grey car pulled up and a nondescript pregnant woman and a curly-haired man offered her a lift. But she got huge bad vibes from them.
Mm.
She wasn't happy about getting in their car, and she couldn't really put a finger on it, but she said no and they drove away. But she had never forgotten about it. She'd always remembered how off that encounter was. But it wasn't actually until sometime in 2010 that she saw a photo of Rose as her younger self. And Sally describes the shock of the recognition as like visceral. And suddenly she linked the scary hitchhiking experience together with Rose. So in her own words, Sally says, "For years I'd seen the West as they were when they were arrested in the 90s, a middle-aged couple. But here were pictures of them as their younger selves. And I recognised them, more to the point, I recognised the car, and I knew it was the one I wouldn't get into. The realisation of how close I'd come to a gruesome end was electrifying and still is, and it started a train of thought that ended up with me writing Toto among the murderers."
Wow.
But to have that happen and it stay with you as like a creepy experience, and then literally decades later realise why it had stuck with you.
Yeah.
And that raises sort of a point as well about when I picture Fred and Rose, I do think of them as like when they were arrested, and yeah, they didn't look like that.
Yeah, it's a good point.
When it was happening, so I can see how maybe if she wasn't hugely into sort of true crime at that moment, she hadn't done any digging on them. Mm. Like, that's what she'd think they looked like.
Yeah.
And she hadn't really seen the car, and it had just passed her by.
Yeah, it's weird.
And to find out years later, and maybe there was something deep down that really hung on to that experience so she could recall it.
Yeah.
But I definitely fancy reading the book that was inspired by that encounter. And yeah, I think Sally's very lucky, and she was good to trust her gut feeling.
I was just going to say, always trust your gut.
Yeah.
Always.
Mad, yeah, isn't it?
Really mad.
Another person who almost ended up as a victim to the West is Felicity Nightingale, who actually found herself in Fred's van. So it was 1980, a little bit after Sally's encounter, and Felicity regularly hitchhiked. This was how she travelled between her home in Weymouth and a Welsh village where she had a summer job. So she was doing this journey all the time. To me, that is crazy that your whole plan for a journey can be to hitchhike.
Yeah.
But I understand that that was a mindset and it was how things were. So Felicity had hitchhiked and was dropped off at a service station on the M5, where her and a guy who she describes as a friendly truck driver parted ways. So she's just at this service station and she's looking for her next lift. And a man approaches her, drives up and offers her a lift. And recalling this, she said that he gave her a strange vibe because he kept insisting that she threw her rucksack in the back rather than keeping it with her up front. And he was just very sort of explicit about where he wanted her stuff to be and just seemed a bit weird. But she decided that she'd get in anyway, so she did. Then he decided that he wanted to go inside the service station for some tea. And he insisted that she join him. So she does. And she didn't really fancy the idea of a ride with him, but figured she was being sort of paranoid and a bit over the top. So yeah, after this sort of encounter, she gets in the van with him. And while driving, he decides that it's too late and he wouldn't be able to get her home for when she wanted, so she should come back to his family house. But she says she doesn't want to, and he kind of ignores this and says he's taken a wrong turn and that he needs to go there anyway, and he starts sort of trying to change where they're going. But she knows that this isn't okay. Like, she's traveled this journey so many times and she knew what he was doing wasn't right. But when she tried to sort of tell him this and stick up for herself, he would erupt with anger. And she's in his car, so she's just going to try and keep him calm, which she does. So eventually something changes in Fred, and he announces that he has to go and see a friend nearby. So he'll drop her off in the middle of this motorway and he says, you stay there and I'll come back for you. So he does. And she is like the middle of quite an empty motorway in the middle of the night. And she really thinks that her chances of finding another lift are minimal. But she knows she has to get away from him. So she is just in the middle of nowhere. And she's stood there waiting, thinking he's going to come back for her. But she doesn't know what to do. And it's dark and fucking terrifying, I can imagine it being. Anyway, luckily for her, she does manage to flag down another truck before he gets back. And this truck takes her back to the service station that she'd originally been at. And she remembers this incident and how weird this guy was and how unsafe she felt. But again, it wasn't until 14 years later that Felicity realised who she'd ridden with on that afternoon at Fred West. Oh my
gosh.
So another person who could have ended up a victim. Yeah. And I wonder what Fred was doing with that. It's just a series of bizarre events.
Yeah, it's really odd.
But there is some more information about both of these women if you give them a Google online. But yeah, totally scary. It was Felicity Nightingale and Sally J. Rooney. Both escaped the West.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I feel like hitchhiking used to be super prevalent, like you're saying before. But I also think that people were more inclined to be scared of the hitchhiker, like, oh, we won't pick them up because they could attack us, when in reality for these young women it was quite the opposite.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Really is. I've never, like I said, I've never hitchhiked or done anything like that, and I don't know anyone who has, but I have got lifts home from nights out with people I've
just met.
Yeah. Which now I wouldn't do.
No.
Scary.
Scary indeed.
So who is it that you are telling us about, darling?
Well, I'm going to tell you about a lady called Corazon Amura. I hope I've pronounced that right. Probably not. And her interaction with Richard Speck. Okay, now, so Corazon was not hitchhiking. She was actually in her own residence when this horrific crime occurred. So on the night of July the 14th, 1966, Richard Speck forced entry at gunpoint into a community hospital group residence for student nurses in South Chicago, Illinois. Over the next few hours, Speck stabbed and strangled 8 young women, all of them student nurses. Now, one of the nurses, Corazon, she actually managed to escape with her life by hiding under a bed. So, who was Richard Speck? So, Richard Benjamin Speck was born on December the 6th, 1941, in Kirkwood, Illinois. Am I saying that right? Am I saying it weird?
I think you're saying it right, but you're looking at me weird when you're saying it.
Yeah, like, I feel like I'm saying it wrong.
Illinois.
Okay, moving on.
When I go into words you say weird, I can whip out a list.
I'm very aware. Thank you for that listener feedback, you bitches. He was born into a large religious family, and he was the 7th of 8 children. At the age of 6, his father died, and he was said to be like extremely close to his father, so he took it badly. And 3 years after this, his mum remarried and moved the family like across the country to Texas, I believe. So the kids don't have a particularly good childhood, and they actually suffered a considerable amount of abuse from their alcoholic stepfather. So not good times.
I feel like this is all the trademarks of something that's going to end up bad.
Oh yeah, sure. So Speck's childhood was sort of like peppered with juvenile delinquency, petty crime, and his own alcohol abuse. So he actually started drinking at the age of 12, and his first arrest is at the age of 13. So by the age of 25, he's an alcoholic with over 20 arrests on his record. And these arrests range from like theft, burglary, fraud, all the way to like aggravated assault. So just to confirm his bad boy persona, in case any of us were in any doubt, he actually has "Born to Raise Hell" tattooed on his arm. Which, wow. I mean, yeah, I feel like, why anyway? But that "Born to Raise Hell" is a sentiment that his wife Shirley can confirm as being accurate as fuck, because she experienced all of that within their 4-year marriage, and she eventually divorced him in 1966. So it's around this time that things begin to escalate. So on April the 2nd, 1966, 65-year-old Virgil Harris was viciously raped and robbed in her own home. And on April 13th of the same year, a barmaid in his local pub, Mary Kay Pierce, was brutally beaten to death. So I'm not sure how, but he manages to sort of like deflect the police questioning, and he just escapes, like he just gets away with it basically. But police actually discovered some of Harris's personal effects in Speck's like vacant hotel room where he was staying at the time, which conclusively tied him to the attack. So he's on the run, in inverted commas, evading the police, and he finds work on a ship. But it seems like wherever he goes, there's just like loads of bodies turning up. Authorities like want to interview him regarding like these crimes that I've just mentioned, but they also want to speak to him regarding other crimes. So there was the murder of three girls who had vanished on the 2nd of July in 1966, and their bodies sadly were never found. That was in Indiana. And then in Michigan, authorities also wanted to question him about like his whereabouts during the murder of four other women. So like there's, wherever his ship had been, there seems to have been like a space of murders. So yeah, they're obviously, you know, they want to talk to him about that. But again, he seems to have this knack of making a bit of a like a quick escape before they can properly speak to him. And so he keeps, you know, the police on their toes, basically.
He seems very lucky.
Yeah. However, like I said, these attacks seem to be escalating, and it takes us to July of 1966 of that year, and this is when Richard Speck arrives on the doorstep of the student nurse's townhouse and knocks on the door. So 23-year-old Corazon Amurau opens the front door, and Richard Speck forces his way in, like he holds her at gunpoint. He then uses his gun to force three nurses from the house into a bedroom, and he finds another three women as well. And he ties them up, like ties the hands and the feet with strips torn from bed sheets. And basically by midnight, three more nurses have come home. So they just get tied up by Richard Speck. Now he assures them that he's only going to rob them, but he's lying. So after stealing from them, he takes them into separate rooms and begins killing them one by one. So the remaining women literally are just listening to the muffled screams from their roommates. Now, I mentioned that Richard Speck was an alcoholic, and he had been drinking before he did this, so he's not as focused perhaps as he should be, and he loses count of how many nurses are inside the house.
God.
Yeah. So Corazon, she actually hides under the bed, and she stays under that bed until 6 o'clock in the morning, like the next day. But all the time she's under that bed, she's just listening to what's going on to her friends and her other student nurses that she lives with. So 6 a.m. she crawls out from under the bed, and she crawls out onto a second story like window ledge and begins screaming for help. So neighbors are alerted, who call the police, and the police arrive, and then literally just walk into an absolute scene of carnage. So they take Corazon into custody and they question her and get as much information as possible. And she's amazing, to be honest. She remembers everything. She remembers the distinctive Born to Raise Hell tattoo, and she manages to give a very clear description of the man that's attacked her friends. So ultimately, she really helps the police to catch their suspect, and especially due to the description that she gave. Because basically what happens is it's a heinous crime, so it's completely like splashed all over the media, and as well as this description and the tattoo. I'm not sure why he does this, but Richard Speck actually tries to kill himself on the 19th of July of 1966, and he like cuts his wrists in this seedy hotel where he's staying. But he changes his mind at the last minute, can't quite go through with it, and so he asks for help, and he's taken to Cook County Hospital, where one of the nurses that's working on him recognises his tattoo and calls the police. So he's arrested and he's taken away. He was actually in need of surgery because he'd severed his artery. So they patch him up, and it's said that like a dozen policemen were like camped around him because they were just like, we are not letting you get away. You are not escaping again from us, you know. So goes to trial in 1967, and he claims that he has no recollection of the 8 murders that he's committed. So Corazon steps up again, and once again she is awesome. So despite like her harrowing ordeal, she manages to give like a really detailed account of the evening, like absolutely everything that happened. And she like, what's the word, unequivocally picks Richard Speck as the guy. Like, she fingers him, she's like, he's the guy. But not only that, she actually goes right up to his face. Like, she's just like, goes right up here, and she's like, it's him. Like, she's just like, the kahunas on that woman. She's just like, fuck this bastard. Yeah, so good on her, absolute legend. The trial lasts 12 days, and on April 15th of 1967, the jury finds Speck guilty of all 8 murders, and it takes them less than an hour to do so, and he is sentenced to death. But sadly, in 1972, it was actually his sentence is commuted to 50 years in prison, because the US Supreme Court abolished capital punishment. So he's going to he would stay in prison for the rest of his life, but he's not actually getting the death sentence. Okay, the murders that I mentioned, the ones that the police were like very keen to talk to him about, he was never officially charged with those murders.
That's a shame.
It is. And what's even worse is that those cases remain unsolved to this day. I did find, I was trying to, this is a massive case and I'm massively streamlining it for this episode, but I did want to mention this because it was so, so strange. But this was actually, in 1991, he actually died of a heart attack while he was still in prison. But in 1996, 5 years after his death, a TV journalist like released a prison video that they'd managed to get a hold of, and it actually showed him in prison taking drugs and engaging in sex with another inmate. And this was during the 1980s, so while he was an inmate at Statesville Correctional Institute. And he actually appears to have had human women, he appears to have breasts in the video. So he'd apparently had hormone treatment whilst he was in prison to transition.
I didn't think things like that would be available to people.
Well, this is the point. So, and in this video as well, he's wearing women's underwear and he's casually admitting to killing the nurses. Like, he's describing and bragging about how he killed the nurses. So as you can imagine, major scandal, and it was kind of used to, I won't say convince people, but it was kind of used to say maybe we should be killing people, maybe we should be having the death penalty, because this person's killed like 8 women plus who knows, possibly more, and done some horrific things, but then can live a life in prison, and then if they want to, chooses to transition, that's okay too. I don't think that's right. I don't think you should be allowed to. I think prison should be prison.
Yeah,
that's not punishment, is it? For me, I don't think, you know, you're, I don't know, it just pissed me off anyway. But yeah, so he died in prison of a heart attack. Absolute sicko. Just really not a nice person. But Corazon, just like so brave, you know. And okay, she hid under a bed, but what else was she supposed to do? And I'm kind of glad to know that she went on to live quite a decent life.
Was she okay?
As well as you can be, sure. Yeah, she went on to, you know, she did become a nurse and, you know, led a really, really good life helping people. So that's the only
that's the only justice.
Rainbow out of that story. But I just thought, you know, like, what, like I said, I've really, really streamlined that, but there's so much there in that case. I know All Killer do an episode on this guy.
Yeah.
But it's just like, wow, how to make a serial killer as you read through his childhood, basically. But absolute, you know, the balls on that woman, amazing.
Yeah.
Just so strong.
That is amazing.
Really impressive. And there's so many, like, I know when I suggested we do this, because I think it's like, you don't often hear about the ones that got away. Yeah. And it's usually such a good story, you know, and it's kind of nice that it can have a bit of a happy ending as well.
Yeah, definitely. My last person I want to mention is one that got away, and one that I think a lot of people have heard of, because his escape was the end of this reign of terror, so to speak, similar to what you've just said. So you may have heard of this, but on July the 22nd, 1991, 32-year-old Tracy Edwards was approached by a man in a bar who offered him $100 to pose for nude photos back at his apartment. Now, Tracy accepted this offer, and when he arrived back at the man's apartment, he immediately felt uneasy. There was a strange smell and it was cluttered with barrels, and his date, or the man that was offering him the money, began acting really weird too. They settled watching a movie, and the man laid his head onto his chest and started listening to his heart, and he said, "I'm going to cut it out and eat it." How, like, you would just shit your pants, wouldn't you? Like, that is awful. So Tracy Edwards, like, brave guy, remained calm and played along with it as if they were acting out some twisted fantasy. He kept him talking to essentially stall what he was going to do, and he took his chance. He punched the man in the face, knocking him backwards, which gave him the opportunity to escape the apartment. He ran as fast as he could, and he managed to report the guy to the police. When the police arrived, they discovered 17 dismembered bodies scattered throughout the apartment, and we're talking like bits of bodies everywhere. This guy was Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey Dahmer, as I assume we all know, was arrested and would later be murdered in prison. But, wow. Unlike the story you told, Tracy didn't have the best life afterwards either. Which is a huge shame.
That is sad.
But, yeah, his immense bravery in that situation to be able to escape. Because God knows how long Dharma would have continued if he hadn't stopped them.
It's amazing, isn't it? I feel like it's just like for everybody, it's just that split second decision, isn't it, on how you react.
Yeah.
That then depends on how
fight, flight, or freeze.
Exactly.
There's no right answer.
No, definitely
not. Like, what is gonna...
You couldn't plan for this, could you, really? Yeah,
definitely.
I think, like, there's so many cases, like, where it might not be... Like, we've been sort of going along the serial killer route, I guess, with this, haven't we? But there's so many other cases where somebody has survived an attack or something like that just because of how they've spoken and how they've behaved.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think it takes a lot of strength, like inner strength.
Definitely.
Very impressive.
You just reminded me of a earlier episode we've done on Delroy Grant.
Yeah.
The London Night Stalker. And one of his victims managed to live when she said to him, "What would your mother think?"
Yeah, exactly. Very impressive. It's like you say, you can't prepare for that, and I guess it just speaks more to have of you as a person, how you maintain your calm in such a volatile, scary situation, and then you manage to get away because of it.
Yeah, it's, I remember so watching impressive. Crime Watch when I was a kid, actually, and there was definitely the odd case on there where the attacker would flee after the victim had said a certain thing.
Yeah.
But you're never to know what would be the trigger for that. And it's not to say the people that didn't say those things were less well equipped to deal with the situation. It is what it is, but...
Well, we hope you've enjoyed that episode. There's loads more cases, and we'll put some in the sources for you with other people who have escaped serial killers and the like.
I wonder if, well, there will be, but don't you ever think, like, have you ever come across a situation that could have gone vastly a different way and you'll never know?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, that's like the 90s for me, generally.
Yeah.
It's like you were saying before about, like, we might not hitchhike because we know that's dangerous and you'd be a fool, but when we're a bit younger, you happily take a lift from someone rando that you've just met in the club a couple of hours ago. Who's to say that any of those people couldn't have been that person? You know, it's, I think you just, it's only with hindsight that you think, wow, I was lucky there.
Definitely. And you can, the thing I'm going to say now, you can keep in, you don't have to cut it out, but when I was much younger, myself and three friends were planning a little road trip to South Wales to see her brother perform in his band that were pretty good. Like, they play loads of bars, one in particular called TJ's in Newport that's like quite well renowned. His band were playing there, so we were gonna go stay in some student accommodation, which was like his brother's friends that no one was in at the moment. Anyway, one of the girls that was going on this trip met a guy the night before we were going in a club and invited him, and he was terrifying. Like, nothing awful happened, but none of us were comfortable with him being there, and he seemed completely oblivious to any fear we might have of a grown, angry, somewhat alcohol dependent man on this trip with us that we did not know, that we didn't know his second name or anything. Terrifying. And now I look back and I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah,
there we go. A
few incidences in the past that I would definitely not repeat now. It's probably the best thing to say about it.
Yeah, and luckily like nothing happened, he was fine, but
yeah. You're stupid when you're young though, and you always think you know the best.
Definitely. So. When I used to work in a shop, I used to sometimes wonder if I'd ever like had a customer who was a criminal, like had done something, because I served so many people every day. I thought there's bound to be. It's how close have you been to a brush with somebody who was a deviant. You just don't know.
You don't indeed. Keep your eyes peeled.
Yeah, if anyone listening has had a encounter with somebody particularly terrifying, do let us know. It would be very interesting. And in the meantime, please make sensible decisions. Even though the onus should never be on us to make these decisions, those horrible people shouldn't be doing those things. You get what I mean? But you know, look after yourself
and stay safe.
Stay safe. Bye.
Bye.